Hello, and welcome to Village, the Intentional Community Podcast. My name is Aaron.
I'm Jazz.
And we'll be your hosts as we delve a little bit into intentional community.
So Aaron, why are we sitting here recording this podcast tonight?
Because we were bored in the car ride home.
We were inspired in the car ride home.
Right. So we just went to the co-housing convention in Durham, North Carolina. And as we were driving home and just talking about all the different ideas we heard and thoughts we had about our own journey into intentional community, it's an interesting process and there's a lot of information out there. And we are just starting that process. And I'd imagine there are other people who are interested in it too. And I thought, you know, hey, maybe we can bring people along with us and just touch on different subjects in intentional community and address that as we learn about it ourselves.
Because we can't keep it in. We gotta let it out. Does that pretty much sum up why we're doing this podcast?
Sure. Yeah. I think that's probably true. And also, I had some microphones. If you were at the co-housing convention, you may have noticed me setting up microphones for a lot of other people. And now I'm using it for myself.
If you've got the microphones, it's just irresponsible not to use them to podcast about co-housing.
Yes, exactly. It's important.
And we've said co-housing a lot already, but the podcast is about intentional community of all different kinds. We've got co-housing on the brain because we're just coming back from this co-housing conference. But there are a lot of different kinds of intentional community.
So Village is our attempt to discuss intentional community, both with each other in a scheduled way, because sometimes when you have kids, a little bit of scheduling helps, and also to hopefully provide information to other people, people who might be interested, people who are already part of communities and just want to hear someone else's journey to community. We wanted to talk a little bit about what intentional community actually is.
Yeah, so we've come across a couple of different definitions of intentional community. And the one that I really like is that it's cooperative culture. It's a group of people who are coming together to live together in a certain place, in a certain way that they agree to among themselves. That's a pretty broad definition, and we're really looking forward to exploring together through this podcast some of the different forms that it takes.
I remember talking a little bit about intentional community with my boss, actually, and he mentioned, you know, communes, because I think that's one that more people tend to be familiar with in a broad perspective. And, you know, I ended up sort of mentioning like HOAs or condos, because those are similar like community groupings, but they don't seem to have that intentionality aspect. You just sort of end up in them.
Right. I think that's a really important way to look at it, is that we all live in community of some kind or another. Right now, you and I live in a neighborhood that is a community. It's a community where we know the names of, what, 4 people on our block, maybe?
Something like that.
And it's not a really rewarding community. It's certainly not one in which people are intentionally engaging.
We're always a part of so many communities. If you talk to biologists about, like, niche ecosystems, there are so many levels you can look at it. You've got like your family community, your hobby community, and you've got your neighborhood community and everything like that. And when we really talk about intentional community, we're talking about geographically centralized community. Particularly now, it's so easy to be part of communities on the internet that share your interest. And what makes intentional community special to me is the geographic closeness.
Yeah, so community is all around us. And in a way, I think that it's true that a lot of people find intentional community online. But what we're talking about when we use that term is not a Facebook group. It's not a listserv. It's people who are physically choosing to live together and share their lives.
And it's found all over the world.
And throughout history. And arguably, what's actually new for our species is these nuclear families, each living in their neatly packaged single-family home 100 yards from their neighbor.
Right. There's sort of this disconnect there. But I think, like, the idea of a village evokes an image of closeness, of support. We have 2 kids, 7 and 1.5. And I know that ever since we had them, that phrase, it takes a village to raise children, has just resounded in my head.
We were driving back from the co-housing conference in Durham, and we were talking about the different things that we had learned or the things that we had wished we'd learned, the things that were touched on briefly and that we needed to go back and research. And we were thinking about the different resources that are available to us to learn, and a podcast is not among them. I am an enthusiastic consumer of podcasts, and you are an experienced producer of podcasts.
Yes, mild experience, but some experience. So yeah, we decided to launch into this podcast, and the goal for us isn't just to provide information. I mean, certainly that's a part of it, but we're not experts.
We are not experts.
We are two people who want to be part of an intentional community and are taking our first steps on that journey, and thought that essentially we could bring you, the listeners, on that journey with us. And in some ways, making ourselves do this podcast is a way to force ourselves forward as well. Like, make sure we're doing the reading and the research and taking the right steps. And we named the podcast Village. And the reason is because to us, an intentional community is creating a village. And village just evokes these ideas of support and mutual benefit and knowing your neighbors. When we moved into our house, we did a welcome housewarming party, and we invited neighbors for like 2-3 blocks.
We did an open house. I think it's in poor taste to throw yourself a housewarming party.
I apologize. I'm not up on the lingo.
But yeah, we invited all the neighbors. We rented a moon bounce for the kids that we were sure were somewhere in the neighborhood. And what, 2 people from our street showed up?
Yeah. Yeah. 2 people from our street showed up. So it was interesting. I mean, and that's not at all being critical of the people around us. That's just kind of standard. You know, the chances of you knowing your neighbors are low. I don't really remember knowing my neighbors growing up, unless they were also children. You know, so we thought, like, what is that community? What is that intentional community that Jasmine and I both want for ourselves? And that's a village. And so we have Village, the Intentional Community Podcast.
And we definitely have some ideas about what community means to us and what we're looking for in that village that we'll someday have. You know, those are conversations that we've been having in some form or another for 6 or 7 years now. But in this podcast, we're intending to explore all different kinds of intentional community, even the ones that we already know emphatically are not for us.
Yeah. There's always something to learn from everybody.
Yeah, really. Always.
Okay. Let's get down to it. What is an intentional community, Jasmine?
An intentional community is a cooperative group of people who come together to live in the same place in a way that they agree to. They might have a lot in common, including shared spiritual beliefs, shared lifestyle, shared meals, shared hobbies, shared commitment to particular political causes.
Shared finances in some cases.
Or they might have almost nothing in common except for that shared commitment to living together.
So is a like a condo an intentional community?
No, generally not, because people aren't living intentionally together. They're living accidentally together. We live accidentally together with our neighbors. If we had chosen these people in addition to this place, then that might be an intentional community. Or even if we were committed to sharing resources and learning about our neighbors and getting to know each other and living together on purpose, then that might be an argument that we could make.
So are there certain types of intentional communities?
Yeah. A collective is a group of people who are usually oriented around one similar interest, and that might be a professional interest, like art, and that might be a social or political interest. There's generally an emphasis on consensus, and although the shared work or other activity generally takes place together, they may or may not live together physically. So a collective might be a workshop or an office where people come together that people are working toward. And, you know, there are also religious intentional communities like monasteries or ashrams or convents. The Catholic worker houses are a really great example of religious intentional community. And there are housing co-ops, where generally the residents are members of a corporation or other organization, and that allows them to choose their own members in a way that wouldn't comply with fair housing laws if it was a normal market situation. So there are communes, which you and I both find vaguely intriguing in a theoretical way, but we have no intention of living in one.
What makes a commune special? That's shared finances, right?
Yeah, or possessions. Commune really emphasizes egalitarianism and equality, and then that often extends to things like possessions and resources and property. Communes often employ consensus or consensus-like methods of decision-making, and at least theoretically, they're very non-hierarchical. There are some interesting experiments in really radical egalitarianism, but it seems like often there's a charismatic leader or leadership group as well. I think there's sort of an association of communist political philosophy, especially when we think about the kibbutzim in Israel, which had, you know, socialism and Zionism as the founding principles and were generally farming or sometimes industrial communities, still are. And that, I think, sort of points to another general feature of intentional communities, is that there is often this sort of utopian ideal.
So there are communes, which are shared finances. There's co-housing,
which is the closest to a conventional neighborhood.
We watched a movie, Within Reach, and they were going around to different intentional communities, and some of them were all people living in one house together, and some of them were different. Is that also co-housing?
That's a co-op. I think that's different than co-housing, although co-housing probably has the most specific definition of any of the different forms of intentional community. The Co-Housing Association of the U.S., who put on the conference that we just attended, actually has six defining characteristics of co-housing. The first is a participatory process, where the people who are going to live in the community are the ones who are involved in designing it. And neighborhood design, it's a sort of a unique way of laying things out that encourages a sense of community. And common facilities, like a common house or a shared pool or a tool workshop that everyone has access to. And resident management, where the people who live there are the ones who are doing the work to repaint things or to cook common meals. It's not just all outsourced to contractors. The fifth is a non-hierarchical structure and decision-making. It's not organized around one charismatic leader. And there is no shared community economy. Once you have a shared economy where people in the community are working for the community and getting their income that way and sharing that income, then it's no longer co-housing.
What is it?
I'd say that's a commune.
So if our business is that, but we still have separate finances, would it still be a commune?
Yeah, definitely. Like at Twin Oaks, everyone, all adults work 42 hours, I think, either making tofu or hammocks or whatever in one of the community businesses. And every adult gets like $75 a month as their stipend, and they can spend that however they want. And if they buy something with it, it belongs to them. But that's definitely a commune.
Recall there are also eco-villages.
There are also eco-villages, which is not really a separate designation. An eco-village could include a co-housing, or an eco-village could, I think, theoretically, just be a completely normal neighborhood. But it's definitely a form of intentional community because it's a different lifestyle than the sort of mainstream American lifestyle. And so it's self-selected into a very intentional group. And with an eco-village, there's this really strong emphasis on sustainability. And every community defines that a little bit differently. But generally, the ecological part of sustainability is definitely there. And often then there's our aspects of social sustainability and economic sustainability. Eco-villages often employ alternative construction methods with natural building, cob, cordwood, straw bale, rammed earth. And eco-villages often have really interesting handmade solutions to meet the community's electrical and heating and cooling and wastewater needs in alternative ways. But the emphasis is really on getting that environmental footprint as small as possible.
So I could have eco-village co-housing or eco-village commune or eco-village, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and those are all out there, and I'm really excited to explore them.
Great. So intentional community is people coming together specifically with an intention of forming some sort of community, which seems ridiculous, but I mean that it's aptly named. And there are a lot of types. out there and a lot of different ways to go with it. I look forward to delving into this further.
Let us delve.
Everybody got a home.
We know what intentional community is now, and we talked about it a little bit. And we mentioned that we just came back from the co-housing conference put on by the Co-Housing Association of the United States. So we sort of got that on the brain. We thought we'd just make that the core topic of our first episode of Village.
Yeah, that was an incredible experience.
It was. Jasmine and I both volunteered and helped out some during the day. So we got a chance to meet people in that capacity too, which I actually think made the experience better.
Yeah, you volunteered way more than I did.
Well, I think we volunteered the same. There was just a different type of work involved. We both raised our hand. We just ended up doing different things. So yeah, we both volunteered. I did audiovisual help and went around and got to talk to the different presenters. And it was, you know, just mostly about like, do you need audiovisual? Let me get your flash drive and set up the PowerPoint. But it actually put me in a unique position in that a bunch of people learned who I was. And I had this good reason to talk to them and everything like that. And it sort of gives a behind-the-scenes look at the co-housing conference and the presenters.
Yeah, and I helped out at the reception desk and got to associate people with their names a little bit more clearly than I might have otherwise because I was handing them their name badges. And also the conversations that I had with the other volunteers there at the reception desk were really enjoyable, and I got to sort of delve a little bit deeper and get to know them better than probably anyone else that I met at the conference.
Okay, so the co-housing conference, it took place, I guess the official was Saturday and Sunday, but they had events scheduled as early as Thursday night and going through Sunday. So it was pretty large, and I think there were like 450 attendees.
Something like that. Over 400 is what I'd heard.
And we got there on Friday, and that's when both of us started our volunteering, and we got to see a few different intensives on that day.
Yeah, on Friday they were having like supplemental programming that wasn't included in the normal conference registration. So it was very exciting to get to sit in on some of that. The highlight of Friday for me, frankly, was getting to actually meet the people who had written the books on co-housing. I got to meet Diana Leaf Christian, and that was really interesting. And I got to meet Charles Durrett, who is an amazing person. He is so dynamic and friendly. And
you got your pictures with him too.
I did. Yes, definitely a fangirl moment.
Yeah, it's celebrities co-housing edition.
Well, I think it's true. And it's just so interesting that these ideas are some that I've been, you know, reading through for years now. And I think Stephen King once said that writing is a form of telepathy. So I feel like I've been in telepathic communion with these people for years. And I finally got to meet them and see them face to face and shake their hand and say thank you.
And then they said, get out of my head. It was a very interesting experience. There were about four sessions on every day and four time slots and four things going on each of those. So there were a lot of different things to attend. And based on what I saw, I'd say, you know, about 25 to 35% of them were about like setting up community, like, you know, maybe like brick and mortar type things. And then another equal percent was about governance and conflict resolution, sort of handling the political climate. And then the remainders were, I'm going to say niche topics, not that they necessarily were small time, but there was like economic sustainability and community and how to best handle the meal programs and things like that that are just don't fall in one of those two broader categories. But yeah, I really felt like a lot of it focused on sort of like co-housing 101, which I think was actually the title of one of them. And then on the other side of that coin, like, so you and your neighbors are fighting.
Yeah, there was one called The Art of the Apology.
I sat in on one of them on governance with Jasmine, and they were talking about sociocracy. You know, I've said that word so many times now this weekend, and of course,
it just sounds like gibberish.
Yeah, and so when I go to record it, it's just like, I'm going to get this wrong. Sociocracy, in some ways consensus, but it was mostly focused on sociocracy, and it was sort of this like roundtable discussion with a lot of people about how to make that work. And it's a really interesting form of governance.
To be continued.
We'll talk about that in more detail on a different episode.
One of the first exciting things, I think, that came out of it for us was we had been sort of imagining our journey toward community as the first step was to get a really solid group together and to bond as a group and to be cohesive as a group before we stepped beyond that group. And when you were sitting in on...
Charles Durrett, he was giving a thing on senior co-housing, actually, but a lot of the things apply regardless. And he was saying you sort of start with interest, making sure that there are going to be people who are remotely interested in the community. And then he said step two was having a site, knowing where you're going to go. And because you can lose so many people when you pick your site, like you've got all these great people together and they're like, yes, intentional community, let's do this. And you're like, yes, and we're going to live 50 miles north of the city that way. And half your people are going to be like, I don't want to live that far from the city. I want to live inside the city.
Yeah. And so that idea about like losing half your group when you get a site was one I was familiar with, but I had thought that that meant that you have to start with a really big group. And it's a really interesting perspective to think that, well, maybe that actually just means that you start with a site in mind.
Yeah. Chuck. I'm going to just call him Chuck because
go for it.
I think we're good friends now. I mean, he knows my name and I know his. So I think
that counts.
Right. I think that's what it takes. I feel like Chuck was walking this line because he even said you can start a community with one person. And at the same time said like, but you can't have a community of one person. So personalizing it, right? He wasn't saying this exactly. But when I personalize the message, what I was taking away from it is if you're one person and you want a community, start.
Yeah.
Find out if people are interested where you are. Find a site. Move the process forward. Establish a vision. And then, yeah, you need to get people involved. People obviously need to be involved. It's a community, not like a tyranny, a solo project. But at the same time, like, this is a community that you need to want to live in. So you might as well establish the things you want and, like, you're putting that in. It seems weird because when Jasmine and I were looking at it before the conference, I know we were talking with people and, like, let's try to establish what's important among the lot of us. Everybody's coming up with different things. So you can't get anybody to sign on to anything. But if we come and we say we're going to live here and these are the general things we want, are you interested? Yes, great. Now let's work on the specifics together. Like, essentially, you're trying to get people to sign on to a vision instead of signing on to an idea. I don't know. It felt so paradoxical in a way. I feel like if I asked him about it, he might even change which side he's on given like the day of the week.
But it's an option.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was nice to feel like we could start making progress where we are now.
Right. There's something we can do to move toward living in community.
Right.
Tom Bradford, who led the session on eco-villages, had a slogan that I really liked, which was that we are the ones we've been waiting for. And I'm going to own that here. You and I, we are the ones we've been waiting for.
Yes. Yes, indeed. That might be why we got married. Yeah. I feel like we got some potential first steps. Making sure that people in our area of greater Atlanta are informed about co-housing, about intentional communities.
And there are two co-housing communities already in Atlanta.
Yeah, so there's some knowledge out there. And I think that there are probably a lot of people who are searching for, I'm just going to say non-mainstream community, another way to interact with other people. And I think that the important thing now is trying to find those people and tell them this thing exists and see if they're interested from there.
Yeah.
As opposed to what we were talking about previous to the convention, which was essentially like, here's what co-housing is and why you should sign up for us. Like, no, like, here's what co-housing is. We'll talk about signing up with us later.
Right.
Once we know if you're interested in co-housing at all.
Once there's an us with which to sign.
Yeah. One of the people, possibly also Chuck, said, if you're trying to convince people to join your community, you're doing it wrong. You instead should just have what you've got. And if they're interested, that's how you get them. If you're convincing someone, then they might not be great community members because they have to be convinced.
The other session that made an initial big impact for you was the one on common house design.
Yeah, that was led by Grace Kim. She has a Schemata workshop. She was just talking about how you're trying to position your common house in terms of just general overall design in order to make it an actual common house. she's saying, you know, it needs to be central to the community, a place where people are going to end up anyway. She talked about a lot of people think like, we'll put our common house up on the top floor of this high rise because it's a great location. But then you have to go out of your way to get to the common house. She also talked about this idea, like there was one place where they set their common house like up on a hill because that makes it stand out. And common houses need to stand out. That's part of it. They can't just look like any old house. They need to be special. But the putting it up on a hill special meant it was more like difficult to get to. And that lowers its utility. And it seems like this very interesting balance point of the house that you need to go to, that you want to go to, that you will go to regardless. Like one of the common features is that it has your mailbox. So you're going to be going by shared laundry facilities, the meals, whatever the case would be. But a lot of times the common house is like, let's say between parking and your houses, like you're going to be going past this area. It needs to be geographically set up, I guess you'd say, from a site design perspective, that people are going to go to it regardless, that all houses face the common house, not, you know, literally, but in the sense that like that is sort of central to the community. But also it needs to be functional. Like if you design it poorly, even if it's in the right sort of spatial geography, it's still not going to be used because you have this sense of, one of the things that I thought was really neat, she talked about light fixtures above the tables. And if your light fixtures are too high above your dining room tables, it actually becomes noisier. It makes the room noisier and it makes it feel more chaotic, and people are often less inclined to use it. Where if you keep the light fixtures low, so the light just barely covers the table, you find that people like lean forward and have these intense, intimate conversations instead of these sort of loud, boisterous, hey, we all happen to be here at the same time. And yeah, it went from there too. And just this idea of, you know, what sort of tables do you want to use? Because if you use folding tables so you can make the room a multi-purpose room, it takes away from the dining experience and makes it seem more transient, less like a home away from home. You know, you want these big things, but at the same time, if you get big sturdy tables and then you want to move them to have a dance party, that's going to be a problem. And, you know, it's going to come down to what your community wants. Very interesting balance of transients and everything like that. Somebody in the room asked, what about like movable walls and things so you can set the common house up to do all these different things? And she said, you know, well, as Americans, we really want to be able to do everything. We're worried about saying like, this is the standing on one foot room because, well, what if I don't want to stand on one foot? But she said that what ends up happening is as you make things truly multi-purpose, they lose all purpose, because as soon as a room is capable of being your music room, kitchen, dining room, dancing room, hanging out room, no one's going to use it for any of those things.
I love all those details. I totally geek out over stuff like that. I read Pattern Language through like twice before I could really digest it.
Yeah. And she actually brought Pattern Language right into this workshop.
Intensive.
Combined her things with Pattern Language. So do you want to take like a minute and say what Pattern Language is?
Yeah, so Pattern Language is this ridiculously famous book by Christopher Alexander, who talked about these patterns that we can apply to architecture and these different themes that are profoundly true for humans and can then be sort of plugged into any architectural project to have a certain result. Let me try to give like a specific example. One of his patterns is the hierarchy of open space, where he articulates these things that are sort of common knowledge, but in a way that we don't really stop to think about them. So he talks about how people feel most comfortable when they have their back to something and they're looking out over a larger area. And so what that means for architecture is that if you want to have a place where people are going to sit down and feel comfortable, you should have something behind them and you should have an open space in front of them. No one's going to sit down in a chair that's directly facing a wall and feel comfortable in it. That's, you know, what they used to do to bad kids in school. And so if you're trying to make a space in which someone's going to sit down and feel comfortable and relaxed, that is a pattern that you could then apply to whatever else your design might be. I think another one is called like something more or less in the middle. And that's the name of that pattern. And it talks about how a public space that doesn't have that central focal point is not going to be used. But putting a bench or a fountain or a little garden area in the middle of a larger space somehow transforms it. And so if you're trying to make a public space that's going to be occupied and enjoyed, you can apply that pattern of something more or less in the middle to whatever else your design might be. Let me see if I can think of another example. I don't remember what the pattern was called, but he also talked about how outdoor space so often in our design is just sort of whatever is left over after the buildings have been made. And that's a huge error. And that instead, positively designing the outdoor space, even if that impacts the design of the surrounding buildings, makes all the difference in an outdoor space that's used versus an outdoor space that's unused. Anyway, it's an architectural theory that puts a lot of thought into the way that people actually experience space. But it's not about a style. You can apply the patterns to really any kind of design because what's behind it are these universalities of human experience.
I really liked Grace's sessions. You really liked some of the affordability in co-housing.
Yeah, I did. Affordability is definitely something that is a strong interest of mine in this context and in life in general, I guess. But, you know, there was this wonderful co-housing community that we visited back in Virginia, and it was actually the first co-housing community that either you or I had been to. And it was spectacular in so many ways, but it was like $675,000 for a two-bedroom townhouse or something ludicrous. And I think that that seems to happen in co-housing a lot. And it doesn't have to. And I know that. And it was really just nice to sort of have that confirmed and to have these other people who are working to make co-housing affordable and to make it available to a wider range of people, get some socioeconomic diversity in there.
There's a, what was the project? Boulder? I don't know the name of it, but in Boulder, Colorado, it might be Boulder.
Yeah, they talked about that one a lot.
I think the buy-in prices when they built the project were $150,000 to $500,000. And I believe now the 500,000 ones they say are like worth a million or so. And I guess 150,000 in Boulder, Colorado is ridiculously cheap. And I mean, it cheap based on my experience of housing prices. It was one of the things, I believe they said that, you know, essentially the expense of the more expensive houses helped cheapen the cost.
Yeah,
there
was a little bit of a built-in subsidy there. And I think that seems to be pretty common. And then they also talked about different ways to get that funding to bring the costs down, and different nonprofits that you could partner with, and communities that had been able to get land for significantly cheaper because they were able to partner with an environmental conservation group where they would put an easement on a large amount of the land and the environmental group would help them buy the land. Everyone's really getting what they want because the co-housers want to leave that land as it is anyway, and they want to have that wild space.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that it seemed like even though there are some grants and whatnot for certain things like solar panels, let's say, I did hear that a lot of times it's actually not worth it to pursue them unless you have someone who really wants to pursue them, because the amount of effort from the community's perspective of like learning these things and filling out the forms and all those sorts of things could actually be more hassle than it's worth.
Well, that was another theme there that I thought was really interesting, was that sort of where you balance the DIY ethic with hiring experienced professionals, because there are experienced co-housing professionals out there. And there are totally cases in which it just makes sense to pay someone who already knows what they're doing.
Interestingly, Pioneer Valley, which is a co-housing community, I guess they have a few paid jobs within their community. And one of them is taking at least the recycling, but I think maybe also the trash to the facility. So like they hired their own trash man or recycling man or whatever. And they said that the reason that position was paid is because they'd have to pay someone to do it regardless. And it was cheaper to hire someone in the community to do that for them than to hire someone outside. So they just paid someone in the community.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And he said, really, intentional community, like, there's so much about it that's like sustainability and economic feasibility and doing things together and everything. And the leader of this section said, really, it's about doing things the way that makes the most sense. So if it makes the most sense to just pay someone to take our community's recycling to the recycling center, why wouldn't we pay that person? Why should we pay someone from the outside? When we have a problem with our electrical, do we have an electrician? No, we'll pay someone from the outside. It was very much just a practice in like, what makes sense?
On that similar note, you also went to the session on Workshare, right?
Yeah, that actually was the session on Workshare.
Oh.
Yeah, so and so it was like a Pioneer Valley, case study. And they talked about all these different ways of getting the jobs that the community needs done. You know, there's some of it landscaping and some of it's more building oriented.
And that's like a hot button topic in co-housing. Who's doing what work?
Yeah, and I guess since I wasn't doing AV volunteer stuff, I missed some of the beginning and I stepped out a few times to make sure everybody else's was going okay. But what it sounded like was that they'd done some different things in the past that didn't really work out well for them. And now they were at what he was calling affinity teams, which I guess they call circles. It was interesting just from a jargon standpoint alone, where he was essentially calling it something so we'd understand what it was. But that's not what they call it themselves. So yeah, they have these circles. I guess the process was everybody wrote down what they thought needed to get done in the community in a big community retreat. And then everybody essentially had to pick tasks they were willing to do. And then those few tasks that didn't get picked by anybody, they got people to volunteer for them. Not somebody's got to do it, but hey, would anybody be willing to? And some people raise their hand because you know what? They want these things to get done. And yeah, okay, that wouldn't have been my first choice, but I'll do that. And so they got all their tasks assigned, and that was what people's jobs were. The guy leading it was in charge of building and grounds, that which is like one of their circles. And he said the key is to recognize there are a lot of things that make the community better, and all of them are work. So I might have to, and he didn't say this specifically, but I might have to paint a house, right? And that takes time and energy and everything like that. But just because someone else isn't painting a house doesn't mean their contributions are less valuable. And he gave the example of kids in the community on a day where everybody's outside shoveling snow. The kids help bake cookies and make hot chocolate and bring it out to the people working. And it's great for the kids because they get to eat some of the cookies and drink some of the hot chocolate. And the people out there working
and walk on the paths
really appreciate it. And there are people who can't shovel snow who can help those kids with that. And they are all contributing to the community in the ways that they best can. And it reminds me of this study book, something that Jasmine brought to my attention once, of Economics of Chores, where equitability, fairness are BS. Just because I spend 5 hours working doesn't mean you should spend 5 hours working. Like, we should do what we're good at and what won't make us miserable and, you know, in whatever way get these things done. And I feel like that was the takeaway of that session for me.
Yeah, as you're talking about it, it does remind me of sort of the way that we organize work in our home. We're a little bit less organized, but it's still that effort to acknowledge the energy that each other puts in as being real and legitimate work.
Right. One of their jobs in Pioneer Valley is, I'm going to say conflict resolution, but it's not even that. It's like somebody who goes around and says, hey, seems like maybe you've been having a problem recently. Is it something you want to talk about? Is it something you can help with? You know, just someone whose job is like community psychological wellness, in a manner of speaking. That is equivalent. And in the terms of fairness and equitability, like, there are a couple guys whose job it is to make sure the laundry machines work. And the community has a standard of 6.5 hours of work a month you have to put in.
And that's like the benchmark. That's not metered.
Right. Right. So these guys who have the laundry, like, that counts towards their 6.5 hours a month, even if it doesn't come up that month. That is part of the work they do for the community. And when those laundry machines break down, their job is to fix them. You know, if that means 1 month they're doing 12 hours on them, well, that month they're doing 12 hours on them. And the next month, maybe they're not doing any. And it's just this really interesting idea that we're not tracking your time. The 6.5 hours is telling you this is how much work you should be doing. And then here are your tasks that their like hub team, I guess, figures out some sort of value. This is where you're going to get your time. And some people do more and some people do less. But the idea is everybody's contributing to the community. No one is able to accurately judge the amount of time and effort other people are putting in. And so it's sort of like a trust system and human dignity system of we all have different things. I hate gardening. And if someone made me garden, it would take me so long to do it and I'd be so resentful. Instead of that, like, what do you want to do, Aaron? Do you want to do, like, do you want to help with our finances? You can do that instead. Work in terms of like a work requirement for an intentional community doesn't mean you have to break a sweat.
One of the other sessions that I really enjoyed was the one on building a healthy group. And that one was moderated by Lisa Poli, who was one of the founding members of Shadow Lake, which is like one of my favorite co-housing communities that we've visited. And by Katie McCammett, who's an incredibly experienced and very knowledgeable co-housing professional and then also a very dynamic speaker. And they talked about the different ways that groups ensure that they're working together in a way that's productive and healthy and really encourages growth. They talked a lot about the social architecture of the community and how to set the dynamics and expectations from the beginning of inclusiveness and participation, especially since it's very common for there to be one or two burning souls who are really trying to jumpstart the whole thing. And Lisa gave the example that when the Shadow Lake group was first getting started, there was a couple who was really taking the lead. And she attributed a lot of the success and overall positive group dynamics there to the fact that they were really clear on where their role began and ended. And they had this sort of concept of servant leadership that they were committed to putting into place in that group and empowering every member of the group to really commit, to really buy in, to really participate. And Katie McCammett made some interesting points about how the group dynamics are more important in selling your community and getting other people to buy into your vision than the actual vision itself. Because if it's a positive group with shared participation and ownership, then that shared vision is inevitable.
As you can tell, I think we got just an awful lot out of that convention. It was just a very interesting experience, and I think we learned a lot from it. We certainly had a lot of talks about it each night after the convention and on the car ride back.
Yeah, and including tonight. Hopefully you can't tell that we're recording this late at night after a full day at a conference and then a six-hour drive home to Atlanta and getting the baby to bed.
Yeah. I hope that that gives you some idea of what went on at the convention. And I think importantly, we touched on a lot of subjects and we want to really go into some of them in more detail and really, really take the time to talk about them, like the work share or
sociocracy,
consensus, eco-villages. I mean, all these different things that can go into these communities, affordability,
design,
architecture. There's so much to talk about here and we want to go into them. So then the segment might have been really surface level with random things, but hopefully it conveyed some of our passion for the subject and hopefully it got you passionate to hear more. And we will have more episodes for you and they will go into detail. So we hope you'll join us for them. For our final segment, we're going to try in every one of our podcasts, you know, 5 to 10 minutes on an intentional community that exists and some of the things that we know about it.
Yeah, so on Saturday night, there was a reception at Durham Coho, which is a brand new urban co-housing community in downtown Durham. They just opened up in last summer, in 2014, and they were sort of the hosts of the conference since it was right in their backyard. There are 39 members at Durham Coho, and it's a condominium setup. It was a very modern building, clearly brand new. They had a lot of outdoor patio space in the front and in the back.
Yeah, it was a really nice building. They had balconies on at least some of the units and garden space.
They had one of the smaller kitchens that I had seen in a co-housing community, but it seemed like it was really well laid out and really well designed. And it clearly turned out some delicious food.
And it was still plenty big.
Right, compared to an actual house kitchen.
Right. But yeah, I mean, because it was an urban co-housing project, like, you know, their space is really limited. So what they have to do with design in order to not only make it a building where you live, but the community itself. Because a lot of times when you think of a community, you're thinking of, you know, different houses in a neighborhood setup. But in this case, your house and your neighborhood are the same building. And that's a really interesting design challenge.
It was really enjoyable to see the enthusiasm of the community members because they had been working toward establishing this for so long, and it's still got that new building smell. It's just opened up, and they were so hospitable to welcome 400 conference attendees into their building, and they were really enthusiastic about showing off some of the different features. They had a really interesting air conditioning setup. They had gotten a historic variance from the state that allowed them to have one common metering system.
It was a common metering for electricity, gas, and water, which right. is what was particularly notable about it.
Right. They also had an opportunity for people who were there at the reception to drive these solar and pedal powered cars that they have.
Elf.
Yes, they have at least a couple that seem to be part of a car share at the community that they can use for going around to the YMCA or the farmers market or all of the other aspects of downtown Durham that are right there next to the community. And you actually drove one.
I did. Drive sounds like such a weird term. I rode one. I pedaled
Operated one.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like a bike car hybrid. It was a tricycle with the two wheels in the front. And it was interesting. It had like a 20 mile an hour max, and you could pedal or you could use the gas. And I did both. And my 7-year-old daughter sat behind me.
She was thrilled.
She was thrilled. We got to go around and try it out.
So it was really great to see how they had taken this very small, very urban lot and turned it into this little oasis for this community.
I thought the single metering system was interesting. So essentially, because they have this one meter, that means the entire building gets one electricity bill, one water bill, and one gas bill. And you know, that's obviously sizable, and they need to divide it up among, what was it, 28 units?
24.
24 units. But they didn't say, you know, everybody pays the same. Instead, it was if your unit was occupied, like the percentage of the month it was occupied, if you like went on vacation.
And the number of people.
And the number of people in it, right?
And the square footage.
Yeah. So essentially, there's like a calculation for how much you owe. I mean, they can't do it based off how much you use. So they're sort of trying to approximate that in this other way. But the idea that it's a shared meter and you never really know probably gets people to cut back on it a little bit. Because, you know, they're essentially going to be spreading that cost to these people that they care about in their community. But it also, because it's shared, you're immediately tied to your community when you're paying your bills. So it was a very interesting project, and I hope to see more like it, particularly urban communities. At this point, we've been to a few co-housing, to a few intentional community locations, but this was my first urban community. Have you been to any other urban ones?
I've been to one urban one in Boston. At the very beginning, we talked about sort of this spectrum and all these different ways that intentional communities can share or not share. And so at Durham Coho, they share meals about once a week, and they do not share any sort of religion. They do not share any sort of finances. They do share their building expenses as monthly condo dues. They don't share any sort of diet, although there is an emphasis within the community on local or food that's also organic and non-GMO, and they do not allow tobacco use. And I don't know whether that's just at the community or whether that's something that their members agree to outside of the community as well. And they went to great lengths to accommodate some allergic members of their community, or maybe they were just planning ahead. I guess I'm not quite sure. Because the ventilation systems were completely separate. So the air that was cycling through one unit was always coming from the outside and never coming from another unit or from a shared distribution point. So someone who was allergic to pet dander could be absolutely certain they wouldn't end up with allergens in their space from someone else's pet in their unit. And it made me think about our Girl Scout troop and how we accommodate food allergies on our campouts and things like that. Because when you are in this community of people, the need to think about other people's comfort is very real. And to a certain extent, considering each other's comfort physically and socially, that's at the core of intentional community.
Or just living your life. You're living your life with others. And I think that's really the core of intentional communities, recognizing that we are a social species. And doing that intentionally instead of instinctually. So I think that's it for this first episode of Village, the Intentional Community Podcast. Once again, my name is Aaron.
I'm Jazz.
And we look forward to more episodes and sharing more with you and hearing from you as we go on our journey together.
You got a song. Everybody got a song. Everybody got a song. Colorful on the song. Gonna sing all over God's heaven. All over God's heaven. All over God's heaven. Everybody talking about a heaven. Ain't a going there. Heaven, heaven, heaven. I'm gonna sing all over God's heaven.
I bet you've got more than one.